Summertime and a living is easy.
It's summer. Time to travel to a beautiful location, relax, and enjoy some music. Which apparently is what all of the classical musicians do, because we can't find any to do classical classroom episodes in town. So, we headed to the hills. And lo, we discovered there are these magical musical oases, called classical music festivals. Every summer, students, performers, and orchestras spend their supposed time off making yet more music. Each year, Classical Classroom is going to highlight a different festival. This year, we traveled to sunny Santa Barbara, California, to the Music Academy of the West. So chill out, hang ten, insert other surfer phrases, and enjoy this Classical Classroom Summer Music Festival series. Hey listeners, it's your host, Stacia. Welcome to the fifth installment of our Classical Classroom Summer Music Festival series, Music Academy of the West edition, in which we have discovered increasingly that I cannot say Music Academy of the West. The Music Academy of the West Festival is an eight-week affair that takes place, as I mentioned, in Santa Barbara, California. Classical music professionals and students converge upon the campus to teach and to take masterclasses to perform and to play beach blanket bingo. Throughout the series, in addition to our featured guests, Music Academy President and CEO Scott Reed, faculty clarinet Richie Holly, and viola fellow Matthew Sino have been our spirit guides. But today's guest is a musical Jedi, and therefore, of course, needs no spirit guide. Without further ado, welcome Thomas Hampson. I had a hard time whittling down Mr. Hampson's bio to just a few highlights, but here are some. He's a Grammy Award-winning baritone. In 2010, he was honored with a Living Legend Award by the Library of Congress, which I didn't even know was a thing. I thought when people said Living Legend, they were just saying something, but it's a real thing. He's also a recording artist, and through the Hamp Song Foundation, he uses song to promote intercultural dialogue. He's out at the Music Academy of the West right now. Mr. Hampson, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you here. And so since we're doing our Summit Music Festival series on the Music Academy of the West, and this festival has loomed so large in your life, let's just talk about that. Like, I know that you didn't come from a musical background. So how did you get into music, and how did the Music Academy play a role in that?
Well, there's a couple of corrections to that, actually, if I may. I come from a very musical background, and I'm not sure how this narrative got started. It was just wrongly quoted or understood.
Lies, all lies.
I didn't have much to do with opera in my background, but I was raised in the Northwest, Spokane, Washington, in the Tri-Cities. My mother is an extremely good musician and played the organ and piano for the church and was herself in light opera in the early days. And I have two older sisters, and my next older sister is a professional musician herself. So I played piano, I played tuba, I played the drums, I played hooky, I played at a lot of things, but always, you know, was in choruses, a boy soprano, boy alto, and then boy croaker, and finally, you know, in the special chorus and all that. So music was always in my life, just not necessarily classical music.
Gotcha.
The career that I'm in now, and certainly not opera. And that somehow got misunderstood as a general statement. So the Music Academy figures very prominently in my life, in that coming out of the Northwest and not knowing much of anything but the Northwest, but being very musical and being very interested in arts and humanities and so forth. My teacher had studied at the Music Academy of the West with Lottie Lehmann back in the 70s, and she suggested, you know, look, you've got to get out of the Northwest if we're going to do this. I was actually on a pre-law path, but you know, as I discovered, or my musical gift noticed and voice discovered me, really, it became sort of, let's see what this is all about. And so, you know, in the late 70s, I mean, it was a long time ago, you know, 30, 35 years ago, I came down to the Academy here in Santa Barbara, drove down from Washington State, visited a master class with the great Gwendolyn Koldowski, who was Lottie Lehmann's accompanist and pianist, but one of the great song pedagogues of all time, and then showed up here on campus to work with Marcel Sanger, and in an environment of young, ambitious, extremely talented kids my age that I had never been around or never been involved in. It was an illuminating, terrifying summer. And the Music Academy is a cornerstone of my personal recognition, the first major laboratory that I could find who I was or that I was actually talented. In some ways, a building block of what then became my career. But, you know, my life changed fundamentally because of the summer at the Academy for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, it sounds magical. Like a light switch went on for you.
Yes, I think that's a very good description. I came back then the second summer, and then I was a bit more of a known quantity. And Marcel Sanger, who was head of the vocal department at that time, really worked me that summer. He was very enthusiastic about me learning and getting my stuff together, and he was very hard on me. And we had a tough time that then kind of after I left the Academy and after I started my career, realized what he had done for me, and he realized that maybe he'd been a little too hard, and so we had a great patching up, and I came back and sang a recital shortly after, and so, you know, it, being a distinguished alum of this institution is a very special place in my heart.
So what makes the Music Academy of the West unique among the other festivals? What sort of distinguishes it from the others?
Well, I think that's the better word, distinguished rather than unique. I think there's a lot of festivals that have similar ambitions. Usually, I mean, summer festivals that, like the big ones, Tanglewood or Ravinia, Blossom, that sort of thing, you know, they are major festivals that have an education program. Then you have other festivals like Aspen and Marlboro and Ojai, just to name a couple, Wolf Trap, and they are more perhaps education centers that also have performances. So there's in the summer festival, American festival scene, I think there's this kind of quotient between, you know, the emphasis on that. What is exciting, what's happening here in Music Academy, it was pretty much pedagogical with some performances, and that seems to be still the core of it, but there's actually now, especially with the relationship with the New York Philharmonic and with other performing groups coming through here, teaching and performing, there's a very lively festival atmosphere here as well, which I think is very exciting. What I think distinguishes the Academy for young artists here, whether vocalists or musicians, is it really is now a place where you kind of, you know, work on your chops during the day and give it a shot in the real world at night. You really have a very powerful environment of serious, detailed self-analysis with major teachers in every realm, whether musically or vocally or language. And then immediately within that pedagogical moment, able to turn it around in a performing environment where you can test that out. And that back and forth, I think, is an extremely important process for young musicians.
Yeah. That's, you know, it will never cease to amaze me how hard classical musicians work. When I first found out about the summer music festival phenomenon, I was like, don't you people ever take a break?
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I think that's actually very important for listeners, general listeners, and especially classical singers, they'd rather sort of think, oh, well, you're gifted means you get up in the morning, you start tweeting like a bird, and then somebody pays you a bunch of money and you go home. And that's not how it works. And I also think that for classic music, there's a certain profundity in everything that we're making audible that sometimes can put people off, or they think that we take ourselves awfully too seriously. And that's not really the point. I think you must take it seriously, but what I think classic music is about is about that whatever that space of time, if whatever that's a, whether it's a movement of a symphony or a 3.5 minute song, where time stops still for the listener and you reflect on a very, very much greater presence of why and who you are. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's off-putting. I think that's actually a great gift. But to do that as an artist, as you say, requires a tremendous amount of self-awareness, a great deal of practice, so that you get yourself out of the way. In classical music, the most important thing is what we're performing, singing, saying, thinking, much, much more important than any particular individual who's doing it.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that is fascinating, that it is about self-expression, but it's like self-expression in the service of something else.
My feeling is that the only superstars that can be superstars in the classical music firmament mm-hmm. are the composers and the poets and to some extent the librettists. But I mean, one is very grateful for the talents one has and you're very grateful for mm-hmm. all the work that you're able to do and so forth. And of course you want to have people appreciate what you do and so forth. But I do believe at the heart of the matter is this greater good. And if your talents are the ones that make that material the most sought after audible in that generation or that time, that's a gift. That's wonderful. But it is still always about what you're singing.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, something that has also fascinated me is that classical musicians are so busy, even those that I've spoken to who are well known, and they're very well known, they're making big names for themselves, but they're almost too busy to even recognize that that's the case. It's like
well, you know, I'm in the last quadrant of my career and it does feel like it's gone by very, very fast. Yes, we you know, once you really start working regularly and intensely, mm-hmm. The schedule dominates your life. There's no question about that. And
yeah.
and I can remember some conversations of some very famous singers as I was coming up as a young man and saying, you know, pay attention. It all goes by very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds a bit overly melancholy. But maybe the real message is that most classical musicians I know are just so eternally grateful that we're allowed to make our living and spend our lives devoted to every day the same thing that passionately interests us.
Mm.
And I don't think that should ever be underestimated. And
yeah.
And when you get caught up in that, when you're given that responsibility and you really are building a career and a schedule and your family around it and all the new challenges and so forth, it's very, very consuming and very rewarding.
Well, let's talk a little about the people who have helped you hone and craft your skills so that you could you could do this thing that you do. You recently, did you just perform the recital?
Yeah,
that was,
okay. I had the recitals on Wednesday,
okay.
on the 22nd, and I wanted to sing a recital for the students here that reflected various languages and various styles, as it were, that one works on. I wanted it to be reflective of the ecumenical atmosphere that any festival, but certainly this academy, represents. And then I sort of just landed on this idea. I did not ever work with Lotte Lehmann, but my teacher in Spokane, Washington, had worked with her. She's always been an idol of mine. And if you have anything to do with the Music Academy of the West, she was the doyenne and still is in so many ways.
Yeah.
When I was here, it was with Marcel Sanger, who was in his day probably the most distinguished French baritone of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, when he passed, mm-hmm. it became a big challenge for the Academy. To find, you know, the new eminence. And in my opinion, there was only one person qualified in any shape or form, and that was in the direct lineage from Lotte Lehmann was Marilyn Horne. Marilyn mm-hmm. Horne had worked with Lotte Lehmann. And so when the search committee asked me what, you know, I was suggested, my conversation was rather short. You know, it's Marilyn, and if you don't get Marilyn, you screwed up.
You did a bad job.
Fortunately, they did, and she's been here now for 20 years and has made her stamp and has formed and helped the Academy move into their new generation, and they're looking very much more consolidate their future, and she has had a profound impact on at least two generations of young singers that are our young professionals today, and it's remarkable, and she's one of the greatest American singers that we've ever had, much less this 20th century. So dedicating a group of songs, whether she sang them or not, I don't know. I think she certainly knows them, but Samuel Barber is one of our iconic American composers, and his songs are some of the finest songs in the English language, or and certainly American language. So that was an easy dedication. And then the last part of the group was my own sort of Song of America and some old songs and American stories that I don't think we should ever forget. So it was a fun program to program and a challenge, and people seemed to get it as a panorama.
Yeah. I was wondering if you would mind picking a couple of pieces and just walking me through parts of them.
In the Samuel Barber, if you have the Deutsche Grammophon recording with John Browning, the Opus 10 is perhaps, you know, Rain Has Fallen would be a very beautiful song to listen to.
Okay.
Barber songs are such a phenomenal marriage of and really the essence of what song is. A classic song is two separate art forms, the language of music and the language of poetry, which really doesn't need either one of them to survive. Mm-hmm. But they enter into a partnership, if you will, and create a third art form with a song. And the basis of any song is far more complex than just either the predominance of the poet or the predominance of the composer. And so there's this metaphoric dialogue of human emotion and human experience, and that equation changes as a static reflection, which is really more the rain has fallen. It's obviously a lost relationship, and very much the musical elements are giving us this drip, drip, drip of rain, and the ticking, this passing of time, and yet you can't get back to is what you've lost. And it's a very moving song and very powerful, and in some ways tortured.
Yeah.
Perhaps the lesser known song "Mein Herz ist stumm, mein Herz ist kalt" is in some ways a love song, and very much an old heart rejoicing again at the beauties and wonders of love in spring and nature. However, the oldening, the becoming of old of heart, which doesn't necessarily mean becoming old, but that your heart is no longer open, that this is what stops that spring in your life. I mean, it can be as graphic as you want and can be as metaphorical as you'd like.
Schluchten ans Ohr mir matt, wie ein Ruf aus seligen Tagen, auch das alternde Herz wird schon nicht mehr das Echo sterbenden Schalls tönt ferner.
One of the tunes that everyone knows is Heimliche Aufforderung.
Aufhebe die funkelnde Schale empor zum Mond und trinke beim Freudenmahle dein Herz gesund. Und wenn du sie hebst, so winke mir heimlich zu, dann lächle ich und dann trinke ich.
Heimliche Aufforderung is just a beautiful love song because it's a boy or a girl, or a boy and a boy, or a girl and a girl. I don't really care. It's two lovers looking across a crowded room, you know, yes, somewhat like across a crowded room. But, you know, and saying, look, you know, don't pay attention to them all. They're going to get drunk, and when they start getting distracted as they're eating and so forth, meet me in the garden like we always do, and we'll have a good schnog. And, you know, that's
awesome.
You know, love songs are great. Strauss loved to fall in love in his songs. And he said that himself. He was quite a beautiful romantic, and few Germans have written more beautiful melodies than Richard Strauss. But, you know, all of song literature has this proportionate of internal, external, personal storytelling. Mm-hmm. The listener should be invited as quickly as possible into that world so they can identify themselves and whatever relationship of what the story may be. And that's my pleasure in programming recitals.
Well, what is, I guess, maybe your favorite piece from the recital that you just did? You can't do that.
I'm no good at that.
You know what? I have to learn to not ever ask that question, because every time I do, the person I'm talking to says, "No way."
I can tell you this. I'm not hired to sing things.
Mm.
I'm not hireable. I'm engageable. I can even be talked into some things. But if I don't identify and believe in what I'm singing,
yeah,
it doesn't mean that I have to even have to like the character. But I have to believe that what I'm doing is important.
Yeah.
And that what I can do to make that audible or even visible on stage is important. Then I can do that. And therefore, no matter what I'm doing, what I am doing is at that moment the most important thing and my most favorite thing. And in the song repertoire, the nice thing about that, you know, singing in so many languages and knowing the repertoire, it's just an endless panorama of various composers. I can't imagine my life without Mahler. I can't imagine without Schubert. I can't imagine it without Barber. I can't imagine it without American song in general. You know, I can't imagine it without French song. You know, that's my favorite.
When you put it that way, I can understand why it's hard to pick a favorite.
I tell you what, when we get off air, you drop the needle and whatever song you like and it feels like, wow, that's a fantastic song, play that one.
Okay. That sounds like a deal. Wow. Well, so what I'm hearing from you and what I think is what people obviously get from listening to you is that you are so connected to the human expression, the humanity of the music and the importance of story, and you seem to have you have learned this craft, you've honed this skill completely in service of that. How do you convey something that ineffable to a student?
Well, first of all, I hope what you just described of my work is true, because that is what I believe in and what I think I'm here for. And when I teach, and of course a class like today, you have essentially 20-25 minutes with each person. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I hold up, I'm there to hold up a mirror. I don't know these kids. They're not my students. And I call them kids because they're young colleagues.
Yeah.
What I can offer them is an immediate reflection on where I hear and see that they're at. And there's certainly a value in that in the masterclass situation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I hope that whatever technical issues, either musically or physically, that you need to get into. And quite frankly, with a singer, you can have all the wonderful thoughts in the world that you want, but if you can't stand up straight, or if you don't know how to breathe, what are you going to do? and as simple as that sounds, that's, you know, this whole notion of support. The notion of support is a rather easy description. Mm-hmm. We athletically, as singers, and I mean that physically, we physically decide and maintain the feeling and muscles of inhalation while we, by nature, when we sing, exhale. Mm-hmm. And that tension is what is called support. That's the balance of air compression. It's wonderfully complex because it all goes through your brain, and it's really more about who you and how you think than anything else, and it's fascinating. But it's a proportion that is always part of what we do. So maybe you're trying to sing a phrase that you know exactly what Schubert wanted. You know exactly where that goes. You know exactly what the reflective is, but you're not commanding your own resources properly or enough or adequately. And so helping, maybe there's a problem that we can deal with. Maybe it's just an encouragement moment that says, look, it's going to be better. Don't kick yourself around here. You're on the right path. Go this way and be convinced of that. But, you know, and of course, then there's the other side of it. Well, you know, you'd be surprised how often you get so distracted and so mainstreamed into your work that you know, somebody like me stands up and says, okay, is this a happy song or a sad song? and then immediately, the young colleague goes, wow, I'm so blinded by my trees that I forgot that I'm in the forest. And I said, it's always a wonderful relationship. But in fact, at the end of the day, at the end of the 20 minutes, if we haven't had a discussion about how to make that, what we just sang, more realizable, more honest, more close to its birthright, if you will, both as poet and as composer, both languages, acting as metaphor of the human experience. If that's what we haven't achieved, even in a 20-minute period, I've failed as a teacher.
Man, that is a tall order.
Yes, it is.
That you've placed upon yourself. But that's, man, I love that. I love that that you're sort of, it sounds like a reality check.
I think it is.
Like a sort of readjusting of perspective. Like you've got to get in touch with the actual material, not just your part in it.
We're in an academic environment here in some ways, but also a public environment here.
Yeah.
But in fact, in the world of, pardon the phrase, professional music, I mean, if you are an artist responsible for your public's moment in our repertoire and their relationship to the composer and their relationship to the poet, everything you have as a person, as an artist, your talent, your training, everything is for that moment at that time.
Yeah.
You must be in that moment at that time at that service completely.
Yeah.
And that takes practice. That takes time. That takes maturity. That takes confidence. It takes honesty. It takes a lot of things. And we may have some special moments this afternoon. Usually there are. And we may have some where someone will go home and say, you know, I just missed that one completely. I will certainly have, I've never had a class where I didn't feel like I wanted to call up one of them and say, look, why don't you meet me, you know, at 6, we'll have a drink and talk about it. I don't quite think I got to you where I want to get, you know. But that's also a very human element of what we do.
Yeah.
There aren't answers. There's paths. I think the answers are mostly rhetorical questions.
Oh, man. That applies not only to music, but to, like, everything. So that's a good place to stop, actually, with some advice for both music and life from Thomas Hampson.
And we've run out of
your time. No, this has been great. Thank you so much, Mr. Hampson. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to do this.
Good luck. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. Follow us on Twitter, Snapchat, Tumblr, YouTube, SoundCloud, etc. Email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Subscribe to us, rate us, and review us on iTunes. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Song Holslander for making us sound nice. Not that Thomas Hampson needed much help with that due to the voice. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing legendary eyes. Thanks to Thomas Hampson for being here today. Thanks to Emma Levine and Kate Oberyat at the Music Academy of the West for their amazing help in coordinating these interviews. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.